Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to the Modern Homesteading Podcast. We're your hosts, Harold and Rachel. I just did it for you, Rachel. Yeah, I'm usually okay, throwing it over to you, making this really awkward transition. I'll just do it for you this time. We just got done with our pre-show, our members pre-show. Had a good little discussion there. And we're going to be talking today about small-scale urban and suburban homesteading, or just small-scale homesteading, whether that's in the country on a small piece of property or in the city or in the suburbs. And I guess the main reason, I guess I should ask you, Rachel, how you doing?
I'm doing good. I was just listening to us as we started this, and I noticed that since we've started doing the pre-show, we're so much more relaxed when we come in. It's actually kind of
overly relaxed. We forget things.
I hope people like it. I think it's kind of nice to have a relaxed, laid-back podcast for people.
Yeah, I mean, right to the point, like I said, we forget to say things that I think we normally would want to say in the beginning, like how are you doing?
Yeah, so I'm doing good. Been busy, like you have around the homestead, just trying to get, spring normally isn't here yet, but this year, spring is, I think, here, but then tomorrow it might not be. That's been my problem, I feel like I'm running behind, but when I look at the calendar, I'm not running behind. But when I look outside, and it's 65 degrees all the way up here in northern Michigan, I feel behind. But then the next day it snows. So I don't know.
Yeah, I'm a couple hundred miles south of you, and we're experiencing the same thing. I mean, it's weird. Like I said, 70 one day, a couple days later, it's 20, for a high, 20-something. Mm-hmm. It's back and forth so aggressively. I mean, my wife actually literally went camping the other day at the campground.
You're kidding me.
Because it was in the upper 60s. The golf cart out, and we were buzzing around the golf cart out there at the campground. And I had to go do some stuff, but she stayed the night a couple nights, and her sisters were out there. And it's like, I mean, this is crazy. I mean, it's first week of March, and you was camping at the campground in 60 degree weather. I mean,
it was beautiful. Like, I loved
it. And then a couple days later, it was 20 degrees, So
it's been quite the shock to the system, too. And if you have allergies, which my husband has allergies, it's been a little bit rough.
Yeah, I would imagine. I don't have allergies too bad, but I am out working in it, and it's been kind of back and forth and crazy. And it's like, it's hard to adjust. Your body kind of regulates a little bit, super cold, super warm. And it's like, man, it's just, there's no regulating your body. It's like, you don't know what to expect. Anyway. Yeah. I wanted to talk about this topic because we haven't talked about it us in a while. We've had some guests on that were urban homesteaders and things in the last few months, but we haven't really talked about it lately. And I feel like something that's been on my mind lately is, we just did a book club where we went through Ben Falk's book, and Ben talks a lot about about setting this legacy on a bigger piece of property and developing it for future generations, your grandkids, whatnot. And that's all great. I keep running into these, a lot of other podcasters and homesteaders that are like promoting this, get out of the city, get your land, move, I get that. I totally get it too.
I mean, I'm doing it.
Yeah, but I get it. But I'm also like in this place where it's like, I feel a little bit discouraged when that's all I hear because I think a lot of people do, because it's like, I can't, or I don't want to, or I'm not in a position to do that. Or maybe I just don't want to do that,
but I do want
a homestead. And I just feel like maybe a lot of people feel like, okay, well then there's no hope. Why should I even bother if I can't get out?
Yeah. And I feel like we're making it sound when we say get out, move out of the city, I feel like we're making it sound bad when there's plenty of people that like homesteading in the city. They like homesteading in town. They like they like growing their vegetables and possibly having some animals and still being able to get on the bus and go see a play or a musical. They like that lifestyle, or they just, there's just no way for them or to like move me. Out, or they have family next door, or
in my situation. You know, my situation is, you know, like I'm in my 50s. We have a place that we've lived in for over 30 years.
Yeah.
You know, for me to move and take on a mortgage in my 50s on a bigger piece of land when I'm doing, you know, 80% of the things I would like to do anyway, right here.
Right.
Yeah. Would I like to have more land so I can have bigger animals? I think that would be the only big plus for me, you know, maybe a bigger food forest. But yeah, I mean, when I first built this, I mean, I almost couldn't even imagine moving to the country because it's like, man, I'm doing everything I want to do. Now, as times went on, I mean, I would love to have some pigs and some cows and things like that. I mean, I think that would be cool. I'll never could have that in the city, but at the same time, it's like, it's just a small piece of homesteading, you know, that I can't do. Mm-hmm. Very small piece, really. I can even barter and do things to get that.
Yeah, those products. Just going to say that. I mean, you can anyway, still get all those farm products.
Yeah. So the question is always, is it worth it on a small piece of land? Is it practical? I mean, are you really going to accomplish anything that's really a big deal? I mean, is it really practical to homestead on a small piece of property? And is it even possible wherever I am? You know, and I think those are the questions you have to ask. I mean, everybody's situation is different. I mean, you might have a 10th acre or you may have a cement slab behind your house. I don't know, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's going to be different. It may not be worth hardly doing much where you're at because maybe you literally don't have any space, you know? Maybe you live in an apartment and you don't even have a balcony. Yeah. There's still things you can do, but is it worth it? I mean, energy wise versus production. I don't know. That's going to be for you to decide. I say, if you have one of these really common, what I would say the average place is in America is probably like these little, what we call a postage stamp lot, you know, where like a 10th of an acre or something like that, backyard, little, you know, where you mow your little backyard and you got a little front yard. Yes, it's worth it. You can grow a lot of food in that space, a lot of food in that space. You know, and then beyond that is it's only better because now you can actually, if you have a little bit more than that, you can even expand into the realm of many food forests and berry bushes and things like that. And even expand it more. If you have a little bit less than that, then maybe you're going to have to do balconies and front porches and, you know, walkways and you can do a lot. And like I said, that's, you're going to have to balance that out and see if it's worth it and run the numbers and say, you know, because there is an energy use on that. I mean, and I keep saying energy use because there was an article that came out not so long ago that blew up everybody. I mean, everybody was talking about it. And I intentionally did not talk about it when everybody else was talking about it.
I kind of alluded to it in my interview with Dakota.
You did. And it was talking about how urban gardening is it's less carbon friendly rather than large farms.
Yeah.
Conventional farming.
Yeah.
And if you read the article and you see how they based that on, that I find a lot of flaws in their theory. Yeah. The study was actually done in Michigan, 73 farms, I believe, to a university in Michigan. And they were just saying the carbon footprint on these urban gardens is way higher. Well, yeah, unless you're a permaculturist like us and you're doing things way different. Yeah. I mean, it's naturally, if you're going to do things in a conventional way, but on a small scale, it could be very, carbon unfriendly. Yeah, it could, you know, I still say it's better. What's that?
It could be. It could be way, way less carbon friendly to have your own garden, but
I think that if you're doing it, like I would say we do it. And like most people we probably know do it, the carbon footprint's way better than any conventional farm. Way, way, way better. So energy uses versus, you know, what you're bringing in, what you're taking out. I mean, if you, especially once you close that loop, if you're working on closing loops, your carbon footprint goes way down, way, way down, which is something I'm constantly working on.
You know, no tilling with.
Yeah. No till. You're not bringing in a bunch of product with, you know, so you're thinking about transportation costs and building costs and, you know, I mean, it's just, of course, I mean, it can always be done better, but there's no doubt that conventional farming has a large footprint, and the way they're gauging that, I think there's flaws in that anyway.
Oh, there was a lot of flaws.
Yeah. So anyway, that's why the reason I bring that up. But it does make me want, I think, and you brought up a point here a while back that you didn't even take it as an insult. I think we were in book club and you were talking about the fact that, that you actually look at it as like we're making such a difference that they're actually trying to attack us.
Yeah, there's so many people that have started gardening and homesteading in the last several years that they have taken notice. That's kind of how I look at it.
They're trying to do studies to try to make it look bad so people will stop doing it because it's actually like it is actually making a difference. And I think it's a good take on it. Don't be offended by it. Be flattered by it.
Yeah. I try not to be a conspiracy theorist, but then they put some article out like that. And it's like, why are you targeting home gardeners?
Why are you, why would that even be a study you would run? I mean, are you, because your intention was to show that it's somehow not as good as people think.
Yeah. You know? Well, and it felt like the intention was to tell people, don't do it, just go buy.
Anyway, there were actually several articles written. I linked to one of them that talks a little bit about the study and how they came up with the numbers and all that. And that link, I'll put that link in the show notes for people, anybody that wants to go look at it. I almost don't even want to support it. Yeah, I think most people probably saw it. Actually, this one that I posted, I couldn't even find that one. The actual one that had the really crazy clickbaity title. I couldn't even find it. I don't know if it got taken down or was behind some paywall or what, but I found other articles that were written about the study also. Because I remember it had some crazy clickbaity title.
Yes, it was horrible.
It was over the top, yeah. Anyway, I want to say that, you know, that I think it's worth it because, well, it's always been worth it. You know,
it has
you think about the Victory Gardens.
Mm-hmm.
In 1943, I mean, just here's some stats for you. There were 20 million Victory Gardens in 1943, producing 10 billion pounds of food in 1944.
That's crazy. That's a lot.
In other words, 40% of the U.S. vegetable supply was done in Victory Gardens, which majority of those were done in small backyards and homes and cities and things.
Yeah.
Two thirds of those gardens, as a matter of fact, were in town, cities, and suburban areas.
Yeah.
And about 27% of that food was produced on urban and suburban homesteads. That's amazing.
And if you see some of the pamphlets, because you can still see like
front yards and
it
everything.
Was, you can see they do like the overhead view, and it was intended for these little tiny postage stamp lots.
Yep.
Yeah.
People were tilling up the front yards right along the sidewalks. And
in fact, when I started listening to you years ago, your song or your intro wasn't really a song. It said "Grow for Victory."
Yep, it was a Victory Garden ad that was put on the radio. It was part of that. You know what? I ought to just put that in front of one of the. I ought to just bring that back for one special episode and just play that.
That was pretty great.
Yeah, maybe next episode. Maybe on the next episode, we'll just play that for giggles, just to put it out there. I think a lot of people were turned off by it because they were like, "It's too long of an intro," you know. So I kind of done away with it, but. It did say a lot. I mean, you had the Victory Garden promotion and you know, and people were, cause it's where I was. I mean, it's I was growing for my own personal victories of health, you know? So it was kind of, it's like a Victory Garden, personal Victory Garden.
That article it leaves out all of that. The health benefits, both mentally, physically, the community benefits of gardening. I mean, here on my little road, we stop and have gotten to know all of our neighbors because I've been out in the garden. I mean, there's just so many benefits to a garden.
It just doesn't make sense to me, for one thing, the food miles on food. I mean, most of your food's coming from so far. It's like the carbon footprint on that is ridiculous.
Yeah. How are you getting
growing
oranges?
That food in your yard? That immediately eliminates so much carbon footprint just in that one thing, just the food miles.
Think about this. If you bought an orange this week, where did the orange come from? Because the oranges in Florida are not ripe.
Yeah, I mean your avocados are coming from Mexico. Your oranges are coming from somewhere. I mean, who knows where? I mean, everything's coming from somewhere because this stuff isn't. You know, you're eating a watermelon in the middle of winter. Where'd that come from? You know, I mean, it's just there's so many food miles. I mean, the food in the United States travels anywhere between 1,500 and 2,500 miles on average. Imagine the carbon footprint on that. It's crazy, and just decreasing that is amazing by having your own urban homestead. Mm-hmm. Decreasing in the, if you do it right, like we do it, you're not using pesticides and herbicides. If enough people are doing that, think about how much you're reducing the carbon footprint or the, not even carbon footprint, but the chemical footprint on the planet. Right. You're increasing natural habitat. I mean, if you're doing it in a permaculture design, like we do, we got bushes and we got plants everywhere and there's invite a lot of wildlife.
Yeah.
We were just talking about it. My wife's like, why do all the rabbits and squirrels and groundhogs and everything always end up in our yard? I'm like, because it's home. I mean, look at it. It's like, why wouldn't they be here? This is where they want to be. You know, nobody, none of the other neighbors are battling with raccoons and possums and groundhogs and all the things like we are. Why? Because we have nature in our backyard.
Right. And, same here. I mean, the deer, like, have a beeline to our house. And we have, and my yard in the summer, you can stand out in my yard and you just hear the bee. I mean, the bugs and the bees and the birds, they just love it.
And I think when the more it rains,
we can hear the birds out there all excited because they're out in my garden getting worms.
Yeah. And the more of that we can put in our cities, in our towns.
Yeah.
How much better is that for air quality and just, you know, overall, just every benefit that that brings into a community? I mean, that's, if you could get 20% of a town gardening and homesteading in that manner, I mean, think about how much better that is for that town and city.
Well, it's, and just, pollinators are so, we need them so bad, just to, even for not non-edible plants. We need them for like native species and shrubs, and we need them for so many things, and having a garden brings
them. I was a little upset because, you know, I have a cherry tree, but I have one cherry tree. Well, it takes two to make cherries, right? So, but it was great because my neighbors had a cherry tree. Cherry tree. They cut it down this winter. Oh, I was like, no, I'm not gonna get any cherries. It was great. I don't know why they, I honestly don't know why they cut it down. It was, I mean, they broke a big branch off because their kids were climbing in it here a while back and broke a huge branch off of it, but it was still alive. It didn't look real pretty, but it was still alive.
Now you're going to have to get one.
I'm going to have to plant another cherry tree, or I'm not going to have any cherries. Cause I haven't seen any other cherry trees.
You're going
to
be out there with your little paintbrush.
But that goes to say too. I mean, it's like, again, if you have enough people in a community planting things like that, we're all benefiting from each other, you know?
Exactly.
You know, we could all have one cherry tree or one, you know, whatever tree that crosses, you know.
Because I can tell you from having, I have three apple trees on my quarter of an acre. And my three apple trees last year gave me, I think we figured it was somewhere between 11 and 13 bushels. What am I going to do with all of that? I shared it with my neighbors.
Yeah.
It's such a community thing.
Yeah. And I think it's one of the huge benefits of it, which we can talk more about that later for sure. But I think when people are homesteading, we naturally use less waste. I know that we take out a whole lot less garbage now than we used to because we compost. You know, we're throwing food scraps. A lot of times what we do is we're throwing the food scraps in the vermicompost bin, but some of them end up in the regular compost, but then we're throwing like paper and cardboard and stuff in the regular compost, you know? And so, I mean, it's like a lot less stuff's going in the garbage.
And you're bringing in a lot less food packaging.
Yeah. Cause you're growing your own stuff. So you're bringing in a lot less.
Well, and
so,
even I mean, if you,
a lot less waste.
Yeah. I just,
And water runoff. I mean, we're collecting water. I don't know about you, but I'm trying to put in as much water collection as I can. And I'm trying to make my property where it's absorbing that water. We're making better soil, which is going to absorb it and use that water. And it's not just running down a city drain and heading out to wherever and total pollution, grabbing all the oil stains and everything along the way and ending up in the rivers and lakes. We're trying to use it up on our property. And I think that's great too. And of course, I mentioned already air purification. I mean, the more plants you have in a city, I mean, it's just gonna be better for the air. So, I mean, there's so many, just the environmental benefits alone. Of homesteading in the city are just amazing.
Not having that concrete to heat up.
Yeah.
Because so many cities have the problem of in the summer, they heat up and that not having that concrete and having,
I thought that was from the meth labs, but
it might be that too. Both you and I have had those.
Yeah, we've had those around.
But it brings it cools the earth down too, because you don't have that cement or that blacktop heating up.
So, I mean, there's the environmental benefits. There's probably way more than what we're mentioning here. So it's really hard to believe an article like that can be accurate because there's so many other things to consider than the production of the things that you're bringing into your property. There's so many other things to consider. So I don't know. I don't believe there's a lot of accuracy in that article, but there's so many benefits. I also think that an urban homestead, just like a rural homestead, can present a bunch of business opportunities.
Yeah.
I mean, you can set up veg stands. You can make all kinds of things in your kitchen. You can, you know, I mean, there's so many opportunities. I mean, literally, I there's a lot you can do. I mean, if I wanted to run a comfrey business, I could, comfrey root business, because I have a lot of comfrey, right? I just hate shipping things. But I'm just saying, there's, you know, you could plant a lot of one thing, or you could make, you know, I make salves. You could sell those salves. There's so many things you can do, even on a small piece of property.
Sell the extra vegetables, sell herbs, sell cut flowers, sell.
Yep. You can set up a few beehives and sell honey. I mean, you could do so many things in an urban homestead. So there's obviously all kinds of business opportunities in that.
And maybe in some ways, if you're living in town and in the city, you might have more opportunities.
Because you got customers all around you.
Because a lot of times in the country, people might have their own few of their own chickens and maybe their own garden. But when you're in town, you often have a very large amount of people and way less people growing something.
I think about
Might have a better opportunity there to sell.
Yeah. Think about Curtis Stone, who was doing all these urban gardens up in Canada.
Yep.
And he was basically just doing market gardening on several small backyards in the city. He's right there in with the people. He has very little footprint on getting that stuff to market. Because he's right there, close in the city.
And almost no overhead because he was doing their gardening in their yards.
Yeah, he's gardening in yards. He's making really good money doing it right there in the city on small spaces. I mean, I'm people who don't know can look up Curtis Stone on that because he used to be really big on that. He's since moved rural, but in his beginning days, that's all he did.
Yeah.
And he promoted really big.
Spin farming, I think is what he did.
Yeah, yeah. Yep. And it was really, really productive profitable for him for sure. So, I mean, there's a lot of opportunity there. And besides that, just turning what is an asset or a liability into an asset, take your house, your home, your property, which is a total liability. It's doing nothing but taking money from you in form of house payment and taxes and upkeep and all these things. And then you turn it into an asset because now it's producing for you. Your property is actually producing food. Yeah. It's producing products for your home. And you can turn that liability into an asset. And I love that you can take that in the city and do that. And I just love also that just in the city, you inspire your neighbors. I have convinced many, many, many people in town to start gardening just because I'm gardening, not because I'm out there preaching to them. I'm just doing it. And they're like, oh, that looks nice. I think I'll do that. And they start doing it, you know?
And even if it's, cool. I want a rhubarb plant or I want a couple of strawberries, it doesn't have to be like their whole yard.
But I just want to encourage people. This is the beginning of what we're going to talk about, a few things here, but I want to encourage people that it is worth it. And it can be practical depending on where you're at. There might be situations you're in where it isn't practical to do it there. There's still things you can do. You can still can, and you can buy, you can support those, or you can bring
you
in
can
the vegetables.
There are
absolutely homesteading activities that you could participate in an apartment without growing a single thing.
Yeah. I think everybody can homestead it.
But as far as growing some food and doing the things, it may not be practical for you where you are, but I would say the majority of suburban and urban homesteaders could do it, could grow some things, can produce some products, and it is practical for them, and it is possible right where they're at. Okay, so let's talk about some of the challenges and maybe some solutions to those challenges. Obviously, space constraints are your biggest challenge.
Huge.
So you have to be selective on your crops. You know, there's a lot of crops I don't mess with because they take up a lot of space for what they give you. So you want to select things that are compact, high yield crops.
Or things that are expensive, but that are easier to grow. I think market gardening, one of the most profitable things that market gardeners grow are lettuce. Because pound for pound, it's very expensive.
Herbs. Look at all the herbs. Yeah, I mean, little container of herbs is super expensive, and yet they're easy to grow. I mean, we were talking about in the, I'll just go ahead and mention here, but we were talking about in the members pre-show, we always give some suggestions of things we're checking out at the time, but, you know, we always have the Dollar Tree. Dollar Tree selling these stackable three-tier stackable planters that make like almost like a garden tower. And they're like $1.25 a section. You can stack those up and plant herbs in those things and have your own little herb garden in a couple square feet, right?
Yeah.
Just growing
vertical gardening.
Yeah. And so you can grow herbs that are obviously a very expensive thing to buy in the store and grow several
things
kinds.
Like what do you love to grow, what do you love to eat, but is really expensive? I mean, some things might be better off for you to grow or to buy.
Yeah.
You're just going to have to kind of evaluate that
and evaluate like the Dirty Dozen. There's the things that are way worse for you when you buy them, and you can grow that are cleaner. You know, there's always different ones in that. I mean, potatoes are in it quite often, and I can't even think of all the things, but there are things that are highly sprayed with pesticides.
I think strawberries are in there.
Yeah. So, and you grow them yourself. And of course, you're going to be a lot healthier because you're not going to, it's hard to wash that stuff off, right? And they call those the dirty dozen. You might pick from some of those that you like. But, you know, high yield crops, things are going to put a lot of food on your plate for the space they take up. And of course, vertical gardening, we mentioned the towers, trellises, anything you can grow up.
Yeah, you can make use of, I actually saw this and I can't remember where I saw it, but it was a picture of somebody had a rooftop garden and it was in the city and a watermelon had grown down the side of the building, but it was way up high. And people were like, uh-oh, when that falls, it's going to hit somebody down below. So they were using vertical space. They were using, I mean, you can, I have actually trellised watermelons and big squashes. So you can trellis all of those. And there's different ways to do trellises, but you can use balconies and buy some netting and possibly use that to grow up. I mean, containers and grow bags.
Sure. Back in the early days when I first started homesteading, I had rabbits, right? And I was raising my rabbits in a colony at the time. And I'd built this little lean-to off the side of my garage. I still have that lean-to, but I've roofed over it since. At the time, it wasn't. It was a chicken wire top. And then I had like places where they could go in there. And it was a colony of rabbits, right? And I put them in cages after that. And I moved that and redone it all. But I had moved them out of there. But I was throwing stuff in there for them to eat. I would just like throw pumpkins and squash and all this stuff in there for them to eat. And they just eat it and go about their business. And a whole colony of rabbits in there, right? So flash forward, I ended up taking a year or two off of rabbits because colony raising brought on some coccidiosis and I ran into some problems. Anyway, I just, that space kind of went away for, I mean, I didn't even go in that space for a couple of years. So I go in there and middle of like late summer, I walk through the door of my shed because it has like a back door in my shed. And I walk in that area and I went, oh my gosh. And my rabbits had planted all this squash and all these pumpkins. All these seeds that were in there, they had scattered around. These things had climbed up, were hanging from the chicken wire. And I had like pumpkins and gourds and squash just all the way through this thing hanging down from the roof, from the ceiling.
Perfect fertilizer because rabbits, great.
It was so funny. And I'm walking through there and I'm pulling off like these, you know, 2 foot wide, gigantic pumpkins were just hanging from the ceiling and they're bending. They're so heavy. The chicken wire is like bending down, you know, squatting. It was hilarious.
That's great.
But I'm just saying this stuff wants to grow up, you know,
you
just got to provide a space for it and it will grow up.
And
right?
some things you get two crops out of. I'm thinking like sweet potatoes. Mm-hmm. You can put those in a grow bag, grow sweet potatoes. They like the heat anyways. And then you can eat the vine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
So, if you think about things like that.
Yeah. You like that with like beets.
Yes.
Beetroot versus beet greens. I mean, beet greens are great. Beetroots, even better.
They're some of our favorite. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, for me, it's like, I've even utilized in the wintertime, I like to keep stuff going. So I've got into, you know, I didn't get into hydroponics so much, but I got into aquaponics and indoor aquaponics and growing food. Even in the winter, you can, you know, put in microgreens and sprouting and there's all kinds of ways to grow things, very limited space. So, space can be overcome.
I have grown lettuce. I didn't this year just because it's been a busy year, but I have grown lettuce in soil inside in the winter under lights.
When I first started growing, I mean, of course, I got into it for health and I'm wanting to eat salads every day. I'm wanting that lots of stuff. And I literally built these two by fours in my basement on the cement floor, filled them with soil, put fluorescent lights over the top of them, was growing lettuce in my basement in a raised bed
this?
I think back then, yeah, it's been years. I mean, we're talking like,
I think I remember seeing 10
years ago I had raised beds on my basement floor with fluorescent lights hanging over them in the wintertime growing
shows
food.
You how long I've been following
you've been around for a long time, Rachel, and all this adventure. But yeah, I mean, just you find ways to overcome it and you do it right. I mean, there's so many, you just gotta think outside the box a lot of times.
Microgreens are so expensive and you could grow those inside,
so nutritious and so easy to grow. I just started two trays of them today in my house. I mean, even in the summertime, a lot of times I'll grow them just because they're so good and I'll grow them. Even though I got all this other stuff I could eat, I just like some microgreens, you know,
right. And sprouts. And I mean, there's things you can do in your kitchen. Even in a small apartment, even if you have no balcony, you could do those two things.
Yep. Obviously, another challenge you're going to have is overcoming some zoning legal restrictions. I have those where I'm at. I mean, there's limits on animals.
We even have those out at our property on 20 acres.
Yeah. There's places maybe where you can't have chickens, you know, or anything. And you got to think outside the box if you want animals, or maybe you just only have gardens and not have animals, or, you know, I mean, but you can also work and try to get ordinances changed. Some people are built for that. Some people aren't. As far as working with your local officials and, you know, and trying to make things happen. But, you know, I still think it's good to engage with them and try, you know.
Yes.
And you know what? Encourage them to promote. Show them the benefits of urban
homesteading. Well, and sometimes it's not that they don't want to allow it. It's that they just don't have any idea.
Well,
it's never been... The subject has never been broached, or they don't know what it is. So, for example, here we can have 4 chickens, but we can't have ducks. And so when I called the township and said, is there a reason we can't have ducks? And they said, no, nobody's ever asked.
Wow.
So, yeah.
My biggest fear when dealing with officials is they read articles like we talked about earlier.
Yes.
And they think, oh, we can't allow this in our town because look at all the bad.
Exactly.
We need to be the ones going and saying, let me tell you about the good and tell you why that article may not be representing urban homesteading.
Yeah, come and see my garden. Yeah. Come and see the pollinators going around, you know. Yeah.
Yeah. Because articles like that will harm homesteaders when it comes to officials because they don't understand. They only understand what they're seeing in like the big, in the, you know, media.
Right.
Well, media says this. Well, let me tell you why they're wrong. You know, and so we need to have to be the ones to explain that to them and say, well, here's what that represented. Here's why it doesn't really apply to what we're doing, you know? And I think it's important that we do have those interactions. As difficult as they can be for some people, they are important. And a lot of times, what's another big constraint or challenge for urban and suburban homesteaders? A lot of times when you're in rural and you're a farmer, that's your job.
Yep.
So there's where your time is invested in your property. A lot of times when you're urban and suburban, that's not your job. You have a job and you're doing that in your spare time. Yeah. You're doing that in your spare time, trying to do all these things. So time management can be a challenge.
Yeah. And that has been
homesteading. Yeah.
I think that's one of the differences between probably you and I hosting this podcast and other podcasters is a lot of the podcasters in this space are one of them or more of them are full-time on the farm or their homestead.
Their farm and their podcasts or YouTube channels are their income. Yeah. And it's not that way for us. Yeah.
Yeah. And you have a full-time job plus.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a full-time, I don't have a full-time, but I have a very, very busy cleaning business that I run. And it's the time constraint is hard.
Yeah.
Because even though we don't have a huge homestead, and I think a lot of people are under the impression that it takes less time, but you and I have proven that a small homestead can wear you out.
Yeah, there can be a lot to do for sure. Yeah. But, you know, back when I was early days in this, I was an over the road trucker. I was working 70 plus hours a week. I'm away from home and I've still made it happen. I had to prioritize my tasks and find chunks of time and I got them done. I was home on the weekends and we would just bust out big projects on the weekends, you know, work other things out when I had time. You know, did utilize some automation, some smart automation, tech with timers and, you know, and water delivery and things like that. You just have to just work around some things like that. So it can be done, but time management is really, really important. I did a podcast with a guy, permaculture apprentice. Well, back and my whole podcast was about time management. I mean,
a routine is going to be huge.
He throws out some amazing emails. That guy gives you more and newsletters. I actually got his course and I did his permaculture course and it's great, but he gives you so much free stuff in his emails that it's worth being on his newsletter just for that.
Nice.
But yeah, his courses are pretty in depth.
I can always use time management stuff. I mean, just as like anybody, I still waste time like anybody does. I get stuck on Facebook and scroll, but it is important. If you're working, you kind of have, I don't know about you, but I'm sure you do this. You have your before work routines and your after work routines. And for me, a lot of my homestead is based in my kitchen and ferments. So I'm checking my SCOBY and I'm checking, which is your kombucha SCOBY.
Yeah.
And I'm checking my sourdough and I'm, you know, I've just got all this little stuff that I do, and
now you got some seeds going too. So yeah, you're watching those.
And spring, it's a little bit more work. Like once those seeds get in the ground, my life does slow down a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. It's
when they're baby seedlings. They're like babies. You kind of gotta baby them.
Once you got to get past that hardening off phase and get them in the ground, and once they start getting established and you can't ease up a little bit, then it's just worrying about weeds encroaching on them and making sure they got enough water and
or,
you know,
weather
things like that.
Or animals. Yeah. But
time management's important. You know, you doing it the best way you can with that, but you can do it. Like I said, I was about as extreme of a case of getting it. Normally I don't try to put myself up as the ultimate example, but there was a time when I had very little time for it. And that was how I built this homestead in the beginning. And I was working over 70 hours a week and built this homestead.
And I think you bite off small pieces and chew them, and then you bite off another piece. So just don't overdo it at first.
It's easy to do. Yeah.
It is so easy.
I just saved the big projects for the weekend, you know, when I had a day off, and I would just spend the day getting it done. And there was a couple times I cordially invited a friend over to help me to get that big project done so I can make sure I got it done in the time that I had to do it. And like I said, we've done a few podcasts on time management.
Yeah. I mean, you've talked about it. You have animals. I don't have any animals right now other than the dogs, but, so you had to build cages and all of that. So it's just learning one thing at a time, and you know, you add things to that.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, there's just some of the challenges you'll face. And those are the biggest ones. There's obviously more, but most of them are, I'll say this too. I'm going to throw this in there. I'm going to tell you, I think that the predator issues are probably worse in some cases in the city than they are in the country.
Because a lot of our predators have no predators. We have
in the country, you know, and I'm telling you, I have more problems with raccoons, possums, dogs, and cats in the city than I ever had growing up in the country ever.
Yeah. We have deer here.
And deer too. You can have deer if you're suburban, really.
You can't hunt deer in town. Yeah. So, they know it. They figure it out.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's another challenge, I think, that people don't even think about when it comes to urban. It's actually, I think, worse than be having a rural homestead. Not that you don't have that pressure. I mean, you have coyotes, a lot more coyotes and things in the rural, but I'm telling you, it is not as if those things do not exist in the city.
Oh, no, they do.
You can have the issues.
We have fox here. I have not seen a coyote here, but we have had a fox in our yard when we had the chickens. We have fox, we have eagles, we have deer, we have raccoons, all of that right here. And I can look and see neighbors on every window.
When I used to colony raise rabbits, and I had that, it was that same pen, and I had chicken wire pen. Well, a cat had got in there. Went out there to feed one morning and caught the cat with a small rabbit, a bun in its mouth, trying to get back through the fence with that bun. And I actually got it and got it away from it, and it skedaddled out of that cage, and I had to fix up the fence where it got through the fence. But I'm just saying, that sounds like, you think that ain't an issue, but there's issues like that.
Oh yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Cats. I know, a friend here locally was having problems with a neighbor, a dog killing chickens. You know, in town.
Yep. I mean, I think in some cases it can be worse. Let's just talk about a few minutes about just evaluating your property. Cause maybe you're thinking, okay, you convinced me, I don't have to wait, or maybe possibly never do it because I can't never move to the country, or it's going to be many years. So yeah, I'm going to do it right where I'm at. We got to evaluate. I think there's some important things to evaluate on your property just to see what the potential is, right? And explore your options. Do you have sun exposure? Because it very well may be you're pinned between a couple of tall buildings and you don't have, right? But do you have a roof access? Do you have other things you can do? I mean, you just really have to see. It does take sun to grow plants outside. Obviously, you can grow them indoors under lamps.
There's some plants that will do better with less sun, and that might be what you have to do.
Yeah, if you do get a little. But you need some level of sun exposure to grow some things. And some will do it with 4 hours. Some need six. I mean, you just have to kind of see what you can grow. And so understand where the sun is at different points of the day, different seasons of the year, how much sun you got, because that'll change in the spring versus fall. Yep. You know, it maybe not be any sun right here in the fall, even if it is in the spring or something like that. So, you need to really think about that and think about where you're going to have sun throughout the year. soil quality, it can be a huge one when it comes to town, because especially there's been a lot of construction. There can be a lot of lead in the ground, a lot of all kinds of
chemicals and things. Asbestos.
So
yep.
It becomes more important to get soil testing done in the city, unless you're doing raised beds, you're raising up and you're getting off that. You can actually guard that, build raised beds, bring in fresh soil, not worry about that. But if you're going to be planting in the ground, you're probably going to run and get a soil, understand your soil quality.
Tests.
Yeah. Because it is important. So understand your soil, you know, evaluate your existing infrastructure. Do you have sheds and garages and whatnot? These things can be used for certain things when you're going to be a homesteader, right? I mean, you can convert a shed into a rabbitry or a quail aviary or something like that. You can, do you have walkways and things like that you can plan along, put beds along. I mean, this is all infrastructure that can be used or even built and built around, because I'm going to tell you, infrastructure is obviously a huge expense when you're getting started. So evaluating what you already have and what you can use can be big. Putting in walkways and greenhouses and sheds and all that kind of stuff can get really expensive really fast, especially with the price of lumber these days. It can get really expensive. Everything is crazy expensive these days.
It's crazy.
So you just got to think outside the box on how you can kind of put in your infrastructure. Check out your local ordinances. If you're evaluating your property, you're going to know what you can and can't do. I don't think, when it comes to gardens, unless you're an HOA,
evaluate the backyard and not the front yard.
Yeah. Evaluate that. And there's even some, I guess there's some towns like that too, where they don't want which I can't imagine even living in a town that you couldn't grow something like that, but can you put in trees? Can you put in shrubs? Can you have animals? These are all local ordinances that you need to find, or HOA rules. If you live in one of those, find out what you can and can't do. And water quality is obviously, it can be an issue.
Yeah, that's what I was.
If you're going to use your city water to water your garden, which you can, but it will do better with rainwater. So if you can set up any kind of a rainwater collection and use that water, it's going to do better.
What is the rainwater running off of? And that's something you want to consider.
So, I mean, these are things that you want to evaluate, consider. And I always take the positive outlook and say, okay, I can or I can't, or there's a workaround. Figure out a way. If you don't want to use your nasty city water, set up some kind of water collection, or use the water. I mean, I can tell you this for sure, that a plant will grow better with city water than it will with no water in a drought.
Yeah, because you're on city water, right?
Yeah, and I watered my garden many times with city water. I try to use my water collection, but we've had some pretty severe droughts the last few years. I just didn't have enough. Water. So I had to use my city water. And you know what? I had great gardens. Would they have been better with rainwater? They would have been better, but they grew.
Well, I think everything's better with rainwater.
Yeah. You can see that when it rains. Everything blows up.
Even my well water that I have well water, the garden still loves the rainwater more.
Well, I try to collect as much as possible, but there's ways around that. So evaluate and consider the infrastructure you have, because you might want to put in some infrastructure for water collection. What I was getting at there. Your garden beds are going to be part of that. Pathways, greenhouse, compost bins. All this is infrastructure that you probably want to have. We're going to want to have. Again, the soil testing, you're going to want to test for maybe, if you're going to be planting in the ground, nutrients, heavy metals, pH levels, really important. You may have to change the pH of your, because most things like a neutral pH. A few things don't, but most things like a neutral pH, grows best that way. Get into making your own compost tea, vermicompost possibly. Consider chop and drop plants like comfrey and dock some other bigly plants.
Back over and over.
Yeah. Get into biochar. I mean, I've recently got into that in the last year or so, and I think it adds a lot of value to your property.
You can do that in a small spot. Yep. You don't have to have a big, huge one. Yep.
Yeah. Do a little fire pit and make your own biochar in that. I mean,
Yep.
Of course, we mentioned this earlier, but you want to pick your crops, but pick your trees and your shrubs. Think about the height and the width of your trees and your shrubs, and how much space they're going to take up and what they're going to shade out when they grow. Put them in a place
because,
strategic, because you might shade out your garden. They may not shade them out for the first two or three years. Think in 5 years, where is this tree going to be, and is it going to shade out anything? You got to think like that. You also got to think about that when you're putting in your infrastructure. If you're putting up a shed, what's it going to shade out, or what's it going to block?
Yeah. Especially if you got a really tiny micro yard.
Yeah. Consider your annual crops, but also consider your perennial crops. Those are going to come back every year, and you know, there's some things, and some of those can take up a lot of space, but yeah. they're also going to require a lot less work long-term once you get them established. For sure. And so they're worth having, you know, but consider that, you know, make things you really like, make a space for them. They're going to be there for, you know, you can put in an asparagus bed that's going to last you 25, 30 years, but it's going right. to be there for 25 or 30 years. You have to consider
and nothing
that.
Else can really grow there.
Yeah. And you can't put anything else there. That's exactly right. It's space dedicated to the asparagus bed. So yeah, I mean, just these are all things that you're going to want to think about. And I say when you're doing that, when you're considering your trees, your shrubs, your annual plants, your perennial plants, pick things you like to eat. You know, start there, because if you don't want to eat it, don't plant it. I mean, so I've seen so many people plant things that they don't like because everybody else is growing them.
Yeah.
Don't do that.
If you don't like tomatoes, don't grow them.
Yeah. Just because everybody else is growing them doesn't mean you have to grow them if you don't like them. And also consider what grows well in your zone. Nothing is more aggravating than trying to force something to grow that doesn't grow well. You can make, I mean, you're growing a lemon tree in Michigan, but you're putting work into it. You know, it's like, if you want to just,
I don't anticipate ever getting lemons off of it. I am growing it for the leaves because they taste good in a tea, you know,
and it is fun to grow maybe a few things, but don't make it so difficult either. Grow things that like to grow. And you're going to,
I mean, and you can
success spawns success. And if you feel good about you're growing a garden, you're going to become a better gardener. It's just the way it works. You know, I love, I start my garden off every year by planting some radishes. I like radishes.
I love radishes.
I like radishes. Right. But man, nothing will kickstart your garden off in the year than having a bunch of radishes in your hand.
Way you can know what is growing really well in your area is looking at what's at the farmer's market, what the farms locally sell. And if they're selling, for example, we sell a lot of apples, cherries, and asparagus here because that grows really well here in our climate. Mm-hmm. So that's what you should be growing. Don't be trying to grow, for example, a lemon tree in northern Michigan. It's going to be a lot of work. It's going to be a time suck.
Yeah. It's okay to do things for fun, but this is part of what you're going to feed your family with, and you need to rely on it.
Right.
Stick with things that grow well and things you like to eat. Again, back to the water management, you know, get your water collection, consider water delivery, hoses, drip irrigation, things like that.
Yeah.
I actually never have used drip irrigation in my property. I've always just done things kind of by hand, and I kind of just do it. Hoses and sprinklers and, you know,
I hope
buckets.
To get to that with some of my stuff, but sometimes drip irrigation just does not work with your system. So we water from our lake. And with drip irrigation, it clogs up. We've tried filters. We've tried multiple filters. It just clogs it up. So we don't use it.
To me, that's one of the benefits of urban homesteading is that everything's pretty close to your house.
Yep.
So it is actually a lot easier to water by hand if you have to water by hand. So, I mean, it doesn't take as long. It's like if we had more property. What I find a lot of times in the country is somebody has a few acres. It's not that they're growing a whole lot more than me. It's just way more spread out. So now I'm dragging hoses everywhere to do things. It takes a lot more time to take care of the same amount of stuff.
Exactly.
So I actually find that to be a benefit.
I actually think it's been a benefit that I have been here for so many years because we actually don't plan on, I don't know if my garden will be any bigger than it is now.
Yeah. But it'll be more spread out, I bet.
I don't know if it will. I mean, I might just because I have had.
Well, your food forest certainly will be more spread out.
I will have more fruit and we'll have animals now. But my garden itself might be a little bit more spread out because my garden has had some moisture issues with the amount of rain that we get. Because everything's so close together, I've had some moisture type diseases. But
absolutely.
I don't think I need to use the entire 20 acres. Like everything's going to still be really close to the house. I'm going to use permaculture zones.
You'll be using it, but you'll be feeding it with like hunting rather than growing.
Exactly. Or harvesting trees or maple syrup.
Mushrooms.
This time of year, and mushrooms and stuff like that. But I have found that I don't need much more than what I have to grow vegetables anyways.
Yeah. We grow plenty, honestly. I grow sometimes I grow too much. I mean, I could be.
Well, I grow enough to can and last us through the year. In fact, I just bought organic potatoes yesterday.
And remind people of what you're third of an acre.
I'm on a third of an acre and I just bought.
I'm on a quarter. I was on a tenth.
Yeah, and I have yet, I haven't bought onions in 2 years. I haven't bought garlic in 2 years. I haven't bought tomatoes in years and years and years, mm-hmm. even canned for the winter. And I'm on a quarter of an acre.
Yeah.
So, I mean.
Third of an acre.
Yeah.
I'm on a quarter acre.
A third, yeah. So you're on a, I'm on a third of an acre. And yeah, I mean, what I buy vegetable wise is usually lettuces and stuff because I still have yet to grow a nice crunchy head lettuce.
I probably grow more lettuce than, yeah, we don't grow head lettuce. It's just hard to grow in Indiana. It really is. I really want to input that into my
aquaponics. And I buy celery because I still haven't mastered the art of celery, but
yeah,
a lot of vegetable, tomatoes and squash.
There's so
and
much.
Onions and kales and bread. I mean, I haven't bought in years.
Yeah. And, but here's the thing. Just because you're an urban homestead, most places, you're not just limited to a garden. And I would say in most towns, you can have livestock as well. There are some places where you can't.
Yeah.
But most, you can have some livestock.
Yeah, I can have some chickens.
Yeah. You can have chickens. You can have rabbits. You can have
and quail. And I could have rabbits and quail here.
If you have a large enough property, you can even have goats. I mean, if you have like a quarter of an acre or a half an acre in town or in the suburbs, a lot of places don't even mind if you have a couple goats. I mean, you can do that.
Pheasant, pigs.
You can raise fish. You know, there's things you can do on a small piece of property to bring in meat sources. I mean, I do rabbits and quail. You've done chickens in the past where you're at. You can do things. Right. On a small piece of property. But don't also just think about, here's the thing. When you think about urban homesteading, don't just limit yourself to your property. Take advantage of homesteading on a bigger scale. In other words, think about public lands where you can hunt and fish and forage. These are opportunities to bring things into your homestead that anybody can take advantage of. And just, you know, it doesn't have to be limited to your properties because you're homesteading in the city.
Well,
you
can go to
public
this,
lands and stuff and get those things.
I have this idea because I actually had a couple of my neighbors come to me about this spin homesteading. So instead of spin farming on people's property, spin
growing different things and sharing.
Like, my neighbors, no, they didn't want to do it, but they were like, more room. The neighbors behind us have 2.5 acres, which means they can have a lot more chickens.
They were going to let you run chicken tractors.
Were going to let us have chicken tractors on their property as long as we gave them some of the chicken eggs or the meat. So option.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's things you can do and barter. Like you just said, you can barter those things. You know, I think that's what we were talking about Curtis Stone earlier. And that's how he got people to give him the let him use their yards to farm
I think,
and he would just give them a little bit of the produce.
That's what I thought.
And he would basically pay them with produce and to use their yard. And that's bartering. You know, you can do things like that. You can trade this for that and bring more stuff. I mean, I've traded rabbits for pork.
Awesome.
Absolutely. I mean, I actually traded live rabbits to a guy for a bunch of processed pork. Heck yeah, I'll do that trade all day long.
Right.
I mean, I mean, there's things you can do like that. And then there's just we've talked about it before. There's so much more to homesteading than growing gardens and raising animals.
I mean, you can homestead in your kitchen.
Yes. We've mentioned how many times. I think that cooking from scratch is the most underrated homesteading skill, bar none, hands down. It is the most important, most underrated skill that you can do. You can grow all the food you want, raise all the animals you want. You know how to cook it, it's going to do you no good.
Exactly.
If you don't like what the final product and you don't want to put it in your body, what good was it doing at all? Learn how to cook from scratch that in a way that tastes great to you, because that is a great skill. But just getting into that point, learning how to preserve your food, canning, dehydrating, fermenting, freezing, all these things, there's tricks, all this stuff. Learn those things because you can do all that on
and
a
you
small
can do
homestead.
All of that on a small scale. Yeah.
None of these fermenting, things are stuff you can't do.
Fermenting, you use a pint. You can start with a pint-sized jar or a quart-sized jar. Freezing, well, everybody has a freezer, I'm pretty sure, even if it's your refrigerator freezer. Dehydrating, you can actually do in your oven without a dehydrator, but they sell fairly small ones. Canning, they have your electric canner, which holds, what, four-quart
jars?
It doesn't have to be this thing that
you don't have to go out and get
space.
$300-$400 equipment, cheaper and do it too.
And if you're living in the city, you can do some of these things. Mm-hmm. Even drying can even be
You can
drying
just hang.
The herbs that you grow, yeah. You can just hang them up. Do that with almost a lot of my herbs. Almost all of my herbs, I just hang them.
I've actually got this basket that hangs, and it's got like these zipper pockets. You can just shove everything in that and let it dry. And wind blows through it and dries out your herbs, and it kind of holds everything in there too, which is nice too. Cause even if I even do that for like seed collection, I'll put stuff in there that I want to dry out for the seeds, and I'll just stuff it in there and let it completely dry out where the seeds just fall out of it. And then I can just reach in there and it holds all the seeds in there, and I can just reach in there and grab them.
Yeah. And so you can do all this living in the city, even if you don't even have a balcony, if you learn to cook and preserve food and make yogurt and make sauerkraut and kimchi and bake bread, and you go to the farmer's market and support another farmer, or you even go to the grocery store and buy some of this, just learning how to cook and eat healthy can be, you know, your homestead kitchen.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we even take it to a whole nother level. I mean, homesteading, it just doesn't have to be, you know, just because you're on a small piece of property doesn't mean it has to be like some lesser thing. You can actually close loops on a small piece of property. I've been doing it for years. I've been working on closing loops like crazy. Like seed saving is closing loops.
Yeah.
You're seed saving, you're replanting. You don't have to bring in that product anymore. You save the seeds, you plant the seeds, you grow the product, you save more seeds. It's this closed loop system where you're not bringing in anything. Plant propagation. You're taking cuttings, your things like that. You can root things, replant them, spread them, you know, grow more of them. Livestock loop. Yeah. You can grow food, livestock feed, raise your livestock, eat. I mean, you have the whole, like rabbits with my rabbits. I mean, they're giving birth. They're making more rabbits. I'm feeding them mulberry leaves and things for my property. I mean, you can close loops in that too. And really implementing permaculture does a lot of that through your food guilds and things, and your, you know, chop and drop and feeding their soil and all these things that you're doing.
And you can start to learn herbal medicine and growing herbs. And some of that can start to feed, you know, you grow ginger because you get indigestion, or you grow mint to help with a stuffy nose. There's all these things that you can do and learn while you're still in the city. And even if you never leave. And then I wanted to talk about that. You said at the end, you have engaged with the local community.
Yeah.
I also wanted to remind people, because I did this for 2 years and I actually really, really enjoyed this. I was a part of our community garden. Mm-hmm. A lot of places have a community garden. So if you live in a city and you have zero options for growing anything inside, unless you grow like microgreens and sprouts, some of these places have community gardens. I had a plot, I think it was 20 by 40.
Wow. That's pretty big.
Was my plot. Yeah. And I paid $80 for a year for it.
Yeah. Wow. You were
and late. Ours, I didn't bench. Apply for it, but ours did offer scholarships.
Yeah.
They offered scholarships and discounts for specific things.
You could do that. And a lot of libraries actually have seed libraries now where you can actually go get the
ours
seeds
does.
For free. Yeah. Ours does too. And you can use free seeds, plant in your community garden and have your garden space. Yeah, absolutely.
Yes. And then you have community, because guess what? Everybody that's at the community loves to do.
Yep.
Garden. Now, some of the people are growing just flowers. I grew all vegetables on mine. And you know what they also have there? All the tools. You come there with nothing but gardening gloves and maybe a water bucket.
Yeah.
They had the hose, the wheelbarrows. They had the water hookup. They had everything. It even came with compost, unlimited amounts of compost. Yeah. And so a lot of towns and cities are starting to do that. And if your town doesn't have one, you might want to talk to them about starting to have one. I just saw recently they're putting another one in because it's become so popular. So there is that option to
be
part of a community garden or find somebody a friend, meet somebody that maybe has a little bit bigger yard and it works better. And maybe you could work out an arrangement to grow some things on their property.
Or just do some guerrilla gardening, go down to the local city park and make you a spot and
plant yourself a little squash plant and run away. Hey, those squash seem to grow no matter what you do. So just stuff it in some ground. Yeah.
Well, we say all this to say this, don't be discouraged. And don't think you have to get into the country. Like I said, there's so much horn blowing going on about get out of the city, panic, get your legacy going, develop your land, do your thing. Great if you can. But if you feel like that's too much pressure and you just ain't going to happen anytime soon, Don't not do anything.
Right. Well, and like you said, if you've even if you just have decided I like it here.
Yeah.
Or you just don't move.
Or you just don't want to, or you just don't want to go in debt for 30 acres, you know, and you think, man, this place is paid for. I'd rather just stay here and make it happen here. Do that. Yeah. Do that. You can do it. And, you know, like I said, there's a lot to evaluate, a lot to think about. Not everybody can do everything that I'm
doing. This is 2024. You can do whatever you want.
That's right. Well, I just think that it's a lot of people. I run into people all the time that just think that they're, again, I've said this over the years many times, that people are always looking for that someday. You know, someday. I was that guy for so long.
Now is the day. Someday. Now is the day.
And you don't have to wait till someday. You can do it.
Right.
You know, I guess what we'll do is we'll just end with that. And you can give your, little saying that I think wraps all this up so well. And I'll say, happy homesteading, folks. God bless.
And grow where you're planted.
That's right.